Oh yay, oh yay, oh yay. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and its Honorable Court. Be seated, please. Case number 06-3143, United States of America versus Timothy McCray Walker, also known as Timothy Scorpio Walker, also known as Timothy McCree Walker, also known as Timothy McCree Johnson, appellant. Mr. Becker for the appellant, Ms. Brooker for the appellee.
Mr. Becker, good morning.
Judge Henderson, members of the panel, good morning. For the record, my name is Robert Becker, and I represent Mr. Walker. May it please the court. The panel in U.S. v. Bryant has already determined that the 5861 count in this case must be dismissed on speedy trial grounds. Mr. Walker is challenging the 922G count as well. Mr. Bryant did not, and that court did not decide that issue. But in its brief in this case, the government made no argument that the 922G count can stand on its own. So I would ask that you deem that to have been waived and rule on the basis of the fact that...
I'm not sure I follow that at all.
Excuse me, sir?
The government said in their 28J letter that the 922G is not something that would be barred by double jeopardy. It's an independent count.
That letter was filed after I filed my reply brief. The government...
When was the opinion? When did Bryant come out?
Bryant came out actually after the government filed its brief. But I made the argument in my brief that the 922G count had to be dismissed as well. The government did not even address it.
Well, but the relevance of it doesn't become clear until, since the government's position was that neither of them had to be, government hardly had to assume that it was going to lose the other case in order to move on with its briefing.
By the same token, if Bryant had not been there and the government had not responded to my argument regarding the 922G, you would have concluded, as I believe you did very recently, was it in Van Reddy? In Van Smith, that argument was waived, and therefore that you would not decide on that basis.
Other than waiver, what's your next argument?
My next argument is that it has to be dismissed even if it stands on its own. And I think I can explain it to you, but as with everything to do with the Speedy Trial Act, it's not a straight line, and it's not an unbroken line. In this case, 3161B requires the government to obtain an indictment within 30 days after an arrest. If the government dismisses the complaint on which the person was arrested, then it comes back with an indictment. That indictment starts two clocks. It starts a 70-day clock pretrial for the charge that was in the complaint, and it starts a 30-day clock under D1 for any charge related to the same criminal incident. So if the government were to obtain a superseding indictment within 30 days of when it filed the first indictment that adds a new charge, then that charge is covered is within the speedy trial limit. In this case, the Bryant court held that 32 days had expired, non-excludable days had expired between Mr. Walker's arraignment on June 10th and when the first motion was filed on August 8th. That would have required the government to have obtained the superseding indictment by about August 5th. It didn't obtain that indictment until file the indictment until February 15th or 16th of the following year. So the 922G count would be out on that ground itself, on its own. But even if it came in at that point, more than 70 days expired after that 30-day limit expired. So even if it had successfully gotten a new indictment before August 5th, it would have had 70 days to try Mr. Walker on the 922G count as well. And the panel in Bryant said at least 39 days expired between November 27th and the day the new indictment was filed in February. In fact, 81 days expired at that point. And so the 922G count would have been barred at both points. It would have been barred because it was not filed within the 30 days, and it would have been barred even if it had been filed within the 30 days because it was not, the trial didn't start within 70 days. And we, of course, are arguing that the speedy trial clock on the first count started much earlier than the government is saying. And in that situation, there would be even more time.
I'm having difficulty with the beginning of the first point of the argument, which is D1, which is, so you regard this as a case in which the indictment is dismissed upon motion of the defendant?
Mm-mm. No, sir.
That's what D1 is about.
Right. Well, no, but D1 is about if it says at the with the acquiescence of the defendant or it is dropped for any other reason.
Right. So that's what you're regarding this.
We're not talking about an indictment being dropped. We're talking about a complaint being dropped. When an indictment has been dropped, you fall into that situation of whether you're under H6.
Right.
Okay, but we don't get into the H6 situation.
The next sentence says, or any charge contained in a complaint filed against an individual is dismissed or otherwise dropped.
That's correct.
That's what you think is happening here?
That's what happened on March 16th.
Because of the decision by the Bryant court?
No. That's what happened because what's in the record. The record shows that they were presented before a magistrate judge on February 10th. On March 16th, the government dismissed the complaint. Okay, everybody agrees they dismissed the complaint. And then they obtained an indictment on April 22nd. And so D1 applies because they dismissed the complaint before they obtained an indictment. And
so then it says an indictment is filed charging such defendant with the same offense or an offense based on the same conduct. That's what you're saying?
And clearly the 922 is based on the same conduct.
The provisions of B and C shall be applicable.
That's correct.
Okay, now what aspect of B then takes you to where you're going?
B says that after an arrest, the government has to file a formal charge either by information or indictment within 30 days of the arrest.
So your view is that if the government or if somebody's arrested, complaint is filed and the government dismisses that complaint, the government must do whatever it's going to do again within 30 days?
No. If it dismisses the complaint, the time after dismissal is not counted. But once it then files a formal charge, either by information or indictment, then I would direct you to two cases. One is Biddle.
Before we do cases, I'm looking for the statute.
Okay. Once an indictment is filed after the complaint is dismissed, no time is counted until a formal charge is filed, okay, by indictment or information. And at that point, two clocks start. The 70-day clock on the charges in the indictment, and a 30-day clock covering any charges arising out of the same incident.
And what words are you relying on for that?
Well, I'm relying on there's a very distinct difference between H6 and D1. H6 talks about charges that the same charge or a charge which, because of double jeopardy principles, must be tried with it. D1 is far broader. It talks about the charge that was in the complaint and any charge arising out of the same criminal act.
It just says that provisions of B and C shall be applicable. So I'm just asking what words in B and C are you now relying on?
We're now in B. I'm saying that a charge after an arrest, the charges must be formally filed by information or indictment within 30 days if the defendant is arrested first.
Well, it's the question of whether a defendant is rearrested on the indictment.
The defendant isn't rearrested on the indictment in this case, and usually not. It isn't.
When the complaint was dismissed against him, what happened?
When the complaint was dismissed, against him. And in fact, the defendants did not know the complaint had dismissed. It had been done ex parte.
What happened to him?
Well, he was apparently detained in Maryland because when he was picked up on this charge.
He wasn't detained in the on this charge after the complaint was dismissed.
He was not detained on this charge, but the link, the clock gets reset. But that doesn't break the link between the arrest on the charge and the filing of the formal charge by indictment or information. Okay? The only issue is the clock in terms of
when it's done. The issue is whether the clock starts from the original arrest which has been dismissed, where the complaint has been dismissed, or whether it starts again from the new arrest on the indictment. I know your position. I'm asking what words you're relying on for your position.
I'm relying on the fact that we all agree that once the complaint was dismissed, any clock stopped. The 30-day clock stopped. In fact, it had expired. But the 30-day clock stopped. And everything was reset in terms of time. When the indictment was filed.
Is your position that once the first 30-day clock is over, the government can't charge the person again?
If this case had started with an arrest followed by an indictment within 30 days on one count.
What if it was an indictment within 35 days? Then you're saying then that would be the end, right?
That would be the end.
And there could be no new charge on a charge arising out of the same.
Except, you know, you would end up with this discussion about whether it was dismissed with prejudice or without.
Yes,
but,
that's right.
But we're not going to. We don't need to get there right in this case. In fact, the trial court has dismissed Bryant's count with prejudice. But the point is, if he were arrested, the government has 30 days to get an indictment. If it gets the indictment within 30 days, then that's the case, and a 70-day clock starts as to trial.
But under your theory, even if it's dismissed with prejudice, without prejudice, the government can never re-indict him. In other words, the remedy you're proposing for failure to bring an indictment down within 30 days is a far more severe remedy than if the government flat out violated the Speedy Trial Act. In the Speedy Trial Act, they can recharge the guy if the indictment is dismissed without prejudice. But under your theory, you can never re-indict him.
I'm not saying that at all, Judge Randolph.
Well, then how can, give me an instance where, to use Judge Garland's hypothetical, the indictment comes down 35 days after the arrest, and the district judge then dismisses the indictment under B.
Okay.
Now, what happens now?
What happens now is if he dismisses it without prejudice.
Without prejudice.
Okay, then the clock has stopped. There's no clock running
at
that point.
The clock ran out. It's
35 days.
Okay,
right. But the point is, there's no clock running. The government then obtains an indictment that's exactly the same as the first indictment.
Which is automatically late.
Automatically.
Under your theory, it's automatically late.
More than 30 days.
But it was dismissed without prejudice.
It's still late, though. Whether your view is that the original arrest is the original arrest, so it's out of time.
That's correct.
It's an endless loop.
But if it was dismissed without prejudice because the government can show, some reason why it couldn't get the indictment. It was trying, but it needed more time to investigate or whatever. It could convince the judge.
You're tampering with the hypothetical.
The
government gives no reason.
Okay. The government gives no, well, then again, the difference, but the critical issue is in that hypothetical. Was the indictment dismissed with or without prejudice? If it was dismissed with prejudice.
It was dismissed without prejudice.
Okay, but at that point, the government can then re-indict. That's what without prejudice means.
Not under your theory, because the arrest occurred, well, when the first indictment's dismissed, it was 35 days after the arrest. So now it's going to be 60 days or 100 days. It's always going to be greater than 30.
After the dismissal without prejudice.
Isn't the answer, Mr. Becker, that you have misread Part B, because you have ignored the clause that says 30 days from the date of the arrest or when he's served with a summons in connection with the charges. So every time you re-indict, if the government re-indicts, they have to they have to serve him with the new charges, and the clock starts running from that point.
But if that's the reading, if that's the way the statute is read, then the government has an endless time to drop charges and then rebring them.
And that
clearly is not what was
It's not an endless time. We have.
Well, you have a statute of limitations.
We have a statute of limitations. And the statute of limitations is not 30 days. It's generally what?
Many years. But under the Speedy Trial Act, the clear intent was to, once a person is arrested on the charge, on a charge first, was to facilitate both for public policy purposes, society's purposes, and the defendant's, getting the case to trial as quickly as possible.
Right.
And the to read the statute as permitting the government to drop the charge and then file a new summons and start that 30-day clock again repeatedly would defeat the purpose of the Speedy Trial Act. And this court has said that already.
Your view is that the in this case, the 30 days had passed before the indictment?
Well, in fact, they had. The original indictment, but the defense never challenged that, either in the did not challenge it in the trial court. The government apparently moved ex parte to dismiss. Defense counsel, I guess, found out after the fact that it had been dismissed.
It was dismissed after 30 days?
It was dismissed around the 15th or 16th of March, so it was about 35 days.
And what's the consequence of the defense counsel not raising it below?
Well, I think that you would consider that they had waived it as to the initial, that 30-day period regarding the initial indictment.
Is that right?
I thought you can't waive.
But in order to raise a speedy trial challenge, you must raise it before trial starts. Uh-huh. And because they did not raise the issue of the defect, uh-huh. that defect, before the trial starts.
Then how do we consider it now?
I think you consider it as the arrest happened on February 10th, an indictment was filed on April 21st.
But
or 22nd.
Is it important to your argument that the indictment was more than 30 days after the arrest?
It is not important to my argument that the initial indictment was more than 30 days, because I believe that the defense waived it by not raising it in its speedy trial motion.
I see. All right. So your argument then, what is your argument about the 30 days?
My argument about the 30 days is when the government filed its indictment in April, and my argument is that the clock started ticking on April 22nd. The day after the government.
So all this discussion about 30 days isn't relevant, or is relevant?
It is only relevant to whether, to the issue of the 922G count, if it has to stand on it, if it stands on its own. It is not required to be tried with the other charge. In other words, if it's not controlled by the clock for the gun charge.
30-day argument wasn't raised with respect to any charge below, right?
That's correct.
The argument you're making now, that 30-day argument wasn't made below.
Well, the argument was made that the new charge was untimely.
But not on the grounds of the 30-day.
Not specifically on the grounds of the 30-day.
Well, if waiver is correct, then why have we just spent a long time discussing this?
I don't think you need to worry about it, because more than 70 days expired. Even if they had gotten the second count before, within that 30-day limit, more than 70 days expired after the deadline for getting the count to bring it to trial.
So the 30-day part we can set aside.
I think we can set that aside. We don't need to deal with it.
That would save us some time. All right, now let's talk about the 70-day claim. Now, the 70-day claim, that depends on whether the new charge starts over or not?
Well, if the new charge, you get back to the 30-day issue then.
You told me I could set it aside.
I know. You have 70 days, non-excludable days, to bring a case to trial. In theory, and this is just theory because it didn't happen, if the government had obtained an indictment when it needed to, okay, on the 922G count, It had 70 non-excludable days to bring that charge to trial, just like it had 70 days to bring the other charge to trial. It failed, even if it had obtained that charge timely, it failed to bring him to trial within 70 days. And that is
within
true.
Within 70 days of the superseding indictment?
No, within 70, even, it can't.
The clock begins running at the time of the superseding indictment for the 922G charge.
But there was no indictment. The indictment that was pending when they got the superseding indictment was already time barred by the Speedy Trial Act.
So what?
In other words, that new charge.
The original indictment did not contain the felon in possession charge, right?
Correct.
So the government dismisses that, and they file a new indictment containing the felon in possession charge, in addition to the unregistered firearm charge. The felon in possession charge requires proof of an element that the unregistered firearm charge did not. Therefore, assume that there's no double jeopardy problem in trying those separately. If that's the case, the time on the felon in possession charge runs from the time the superseding indictment came down, in which case the trial occurred within 70 days and you lose.
Well, except that there are two points that I would take issue with. One is the government never dismissed the first indictment before it obtained the superseding indictment.
So
it simply came into court with an indictment that corrected the error in the first indictment and added a new charge. And the question then becomes, and that happened long after the time for trial on the original charge had expired. It was still out there. Mr. Walker was still incarcerated on a charge arising out of this incident.
Why does that matter? Why does it matter?
Well, because one of the issues in terms of speedy trial, whether it's under the due process or under the Speedy Trial Act, is bringing cases to trial quickly so that defendants.
Well, I didn't read a constitutional claim in your book.
And there is not one, but I'm saying that's the one of the underlying theories.
Not the underlying theory, but I need the words. What words here in the Speedy Trial Act are you relying on for this principle that if the superseder is filed after the time with a new charge is filed, so that the first charge is gone because of the Speedy Trial Act violation, but the second, why is the second automatically gone?
The second is automatically gone, again, because under D1 and B, it was filed too late.
So we're back to the 30 days.
We're back to the 30 days.
Which you've waived.
Which we haven't waived.
Well, did they raise that argument before the trial? You told me that it's waived.
I think the argument that was waived regarded the period between February 10th, when the presentment happened, and April 21st.
Why isn't the argument you're making today, why couldn't it have been made before the trial? Why isn't the whole argument, in fact, why isn't everything in your brief on the Speedy Trial Act, why couldn't that have been raised before?
Well, it was raised before trial.
Not
it was
this
not
argument.
Raised in that, in the granularity we're talking about it today.
Well, it's one thing to say Speedy Trial Act. It's another thing to say the reason. You agree that, at least with respect to the first charge, if you don't give the 30-day reason, then you're out.
But the first charge is already out on the 70-day issue.
I understand we have a prior panel decision, and the government agrees. So you can't lose that one. They've agreed to it. You're not going to lose any ground here. The question is whether you're going to gain any ground.
I guess my answer to that is, if the government had made the argument here that the 922G count stood on its own, then I certainly would have responded to it in this court. But the government never made that argument.
I'm not asking about respondent in this court. I thought you agreed the problem is the waiver in the court below.
And what I'm saying to you is the waiver in the court below regarded the period of time between the original complaint on which they were arrested and the indictment, the first indictment. The judge, in fact, assumed in the court below that the 922G count had to be tried with the 5861 count. He said, in response to the defense counsel's argument, he said, well, I agree with you. If I dismiss the 5861 count, then they're out on the 922G count as well. So the issue didn't even come up because the judge, whether correctly or not, considered the two counts related to each other and that ended the discussion.
Okay, thanks.
Okay. Unless you have any further questions, I've gone way over my time, and I will sit down.
All right, thank you. Ms. Booker.
Good morning. May it please the court. Stephanie Brooker on behalf of the United States. Appellant has focused today on whether his conviction under 922G should be reversed for a violation of the Speedy Trial Act. The government has conceded that under the court's Bryant decision that his conviction under 5861 for having an unregistered firearm is reversible, and Bryant controls Mr. Walker's conviction in that same regard. Appellant has said today that it's not straightforward whether his conviction under 922G should be reversed. The government believes that it is straightforward. In this case, appellant was indicted on a superseding indictment on February 16th for the 922G charge. He then was tried on March 20th, well within the 70-day limit. And this court's decision in 1991 in the Marshall case says that when you have a new charge and a superseding indictment, that a new clock governs that charge unless it's the same offense from the original indictment or an offense that has to be joined under double jeopardy principles. And courts have used the Blockberger test to determine whether it is an offense that needed to be joined under double jeopardy principles. As we cited in our 28J letter, the Concepcion case out of the Second Circuit said that clearly those two charges, the 5861 and the 922G, have elements that each other does not. So we would argue that in this case, it is a straightforward question that the 922G count should not be reversed. Appellant has attempted to argue that because there was a complaint filed in this case on February 10th, that therefore that links back the superseding indictment. The government would argue, and we did so in citing the Biddle case in our opening brief, that that's simply irrelevant here. We're looking at a new charge under 922G on a superseding indictment that the charge did not need to be joined with the offense in the original indictment. So it's the government's view that this is simply a straightforward question under...
What do you do about the language in D1 that sets at least that clock with respect to an offense based on the same conduct or arising from the same criminal episode?
Your Honor, with respect to D1, and I will, if the court will allow me, direct the court to the Biddle case, it said that D1 is arguably confusing and ambiguous, but that when you have a complaint that is dismissed, that then when the government brings a new charge, the time clock begins anew. So it's the government's position that the arrest and complaint on the 5861 charge on February 10th is simply irrelevant for purposes of this case, and that the parties appropriately agreed below that June 11th is the right starting point under the analysis that this court went through in Bryant.
What if the time is already run? One thing if it's still within the 30 days. What if it's after the 30 days?
Well, if it's after the 30 days, Your Honor, I think that Biddle sets out the procedure for that, that if the government does not obtain an indictment within 30 days of the complaint and it's dismissed, the defendant then, when the indictment is later filed, can ask the trial court to determine whether that complaint should have been done with or without prejudice. And that's precisely what happened in Biddle. The court went through that analysis. So the government would argue that that's the remedy for the concern that appellant is bringing forth here, that to try to link the superseding...
I'm not sure. So then you're saying that there is a Speedy Trial Act violation, and the question is whether the indictment should be dismissed for prejudice or for lack of prejudice, with lack of prejudice.
The government would not argue that there is a speedy trial violation when we do not indict within 30 days, but that there is a remedy for that, which is that the defendant can ask that a determination be made whether the complaint should have been dismissed with or without prejudice.
Is there a provision of the Speedy Trial Act that says that?
Your Honor, the Biddle Court said that D1 is the governing provision, although it admittedly that the language is not as clear as one might like, but that's how D1 should most appropriately be read. And in fact, when you look at the question at issue here, we're really in the realm of H6, where you have an indictment and then a superseding indictment, that's the relevant provision, and you look at whether it's the same offense in the superseding indictment or an offense that was required to be joined.
Let me ask you about there are two shotguns, the Stevens shotgun, which did not have to be registered, and the H&R shotgun found in the car, the SUV, that did have to be registered, right? There's no contention by the defendant. The defendant doesn't contend that he didn't possess the Stevens shotgun, right?
Yes, Your Honor, that is a concession.
He just conceded that. The relevance, then, of the H&R shotgun really only goes to sentencing, doesn't it?
Yes, Your Honor. Appellant has set forward that under the sentencing guidelines, he went from a 20 to a 22.
Because of the H&R shotgun?
Yes, Your Honor. And
because it had to be registered. It was a felon in possession of an unregistered firearm, right? Which leads to my question. The sufficiency of the evidence in terms of beyond a reasonable doubt, do we even have to consider that with respect to the H&R shotgun? Because it only goes to sentencing, and at sentencing, his possession of that shotgun would be determined by a preponderance of the evidence. It's a related offense.
Yes, Your Honor. The government...
You haven't argued that, but I don't understand why not. In other words, the 922G conviction is supported by the Stevens shotgun alone, right?
Yes.
Okay. So, you know, who cares whether there was evidence beyond a reasonable doubt that he possessed the H&R shotgun? At sentencing, all he had to prove was a preponderance of the evidence.
My concern, Your Honor, in saying that the court does not have to consider it at all is if, therefore, the argument is that because that analysis was not done below in terms of did it meet a preponderance of the evidence standard, if the defendant is entitled to a consideration of that question by the court so that he, therefore, could argue below on a remand whether the government could meet even the preponderance of the evidence standard, and that's.
Was there a motion for a new trial after the jury returned a verdict?
Your Honor, appellant made a motion under Rule 29, both an oral motion at the time of trial, of course, and a written motion regarding a motion for judgment of acquittal. But he did not argue that point. It was purely an issue of constructive possession.
No, I understand that, but that necessarily means that the district judge found that there was evidence beyond a reasonable doubt to support the H&R. So the fact that the district judge didn't make a separate determination of preponderance of the evidence at sentencing doesn't matter.
Yes, Your Honor, and put forth that way, it does give the government comfort that question was necessarily considered to the defendant's benefit.
All right.
If the court has no further questions, we would respectfully request that you affirm the judgment of the district court. Thank you.
All right. Does Mr. Becker have any time? Does anyone have questions?
I wouldn't mind if he wants. I wouldn't mind if he wanted to answer that last point.
All right. We'll give you 1 minute.
Thank you. Judge Marshall, I believe there was a special verdict, and the jury was asked to decide as to both guns.
And it did decide as to.
And it did decide as to both guns.
So what?
Well, I guess there is the
suppose we could set aside the H&R charge, and he'd still be guilty of violating 922G. Then the question would become what his sentence should be, and at sentencing, The only question is whether there was a preponderance of the evidence to support the constructive possession. There clearly was.
But under a special verdict, I'm not sure that the judge has the authority to then say, no, I'm going to find that that gun, he wasn't in constructive possession of that gun. So he's locked. He's locked into it.
Why? You challenge the sufficiency of the evidence, right? He's not locked into that. That's up to him to decide.
Again, he's not going to, whether he would overturn a jury verdict on that issue.
So you're not saying, so he didn't decide de novo that it was beyond a reasonable doubt. He decided merely that a reasonable jury could conclude it.
He decided whether a reasonable jury could, and that's the issue here. And if that charge was not sufficient, if that evidence was not sufficient, then he is then in the position to make a decision about whether to add the points or not. But under this
So there'd be an interesting question whether the decision that a reasonable jury could find beyond a reasonable doubt is equivalent to a de novo decision of preponderance. An interesting question.
Yes. May I just cite one case to you, because I started to and you cut me off at one point. Interpreting U.S. v. Biddle, the 11th Circuit in U.S. v. Puett, P-U-E-T-T, 735, Fed 2nd, 1331, in 1984, said the better construction of Section 3161D-1 is that after the dismissal of the complaint, the Act's time limits run anew from the date of filing of the subsequent complaint or indictment. Not just the 70-day clock, both time limits, the 30-day and the 70-day. So really, Biddle and Puett support Mr.
How can the 30-day period run? That makes no sense at all.
Because
the
30-day
period is the period from arrest to indictment, and you're saying it runs from when the new indictment comes down, the 30-day period starts running. What does it run to?
Well, because when the 30-day period covers arrest to indictment, in which time often a defendant is arrested on one charge and the indictment comes down with seven, with all the charges related to the incident. And so that 30-day period allows the government to bring in all its charges related to that one criminal
incident.
All right,
put it this way. There's no requirement that the defendant be arrested within 30 days of the indictment, is there?
No, but it's the other way around.
Right.
It's that once the person is arrested, there's this 30-day time period.
Okay.
And just Judge Henderson in Marshall.
You're violating the speedy appellate.
Okay, sorry.
Mr. Becker, you were appointed by the court. We thank you for your
yes.
very able assistance.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Call the next case, please.